Welcome to Risky Business, a show where we get to explore new and innovative ways to understand and reduce risk by bringing together some of the leading professionals in the transportation and the insurance industry. My name is Scott Grandis. I hope you enjoy the show. Let's kick it off. All right. Well, welcome back to Risky Business. I have one of my friends from London on with us today, Mr. Chris Moore, the head of iBot over at Apollo. And today's session is going to be on innovation. And Chris, I've told you this. When I think about innovation, I think about Chris Moore, because you're always getting into the new stuff. I look on LinkedIn all the time. You're doing something with all these new things. So yeah, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background? Tell us what you look at, why you look at innovation. You tend to, in my opinion, lean towards the new things, which I love.
Yeah, so I'm an insurance underwriter for US casualty by trade, working out the London market in Lloyd's. I was at a company called Catlin, and then we transitioned over to set up a new portfolio at Apollo. And, you know, when you set up a new sort of casualty offering within a company that was pretty new at the time. So when I joined, the company was only 2 years old. So I was at Apollo 14. So it felt like a startup. And as most startups will know, when you're there, you have to kind of box a bit differently, right? You have to operate in a market and make a presence for yourself. And normally just doing exactly what the rest of the market does isn't going to really get you anywhere. So we had to start looking at new risks and new ways of doing things. So I suppose you could bucket that as innovation. And the timing was such that there was a huge amount of innovating going on in the way that we live our lives and digitalization. And so we sort of stumbled upon this industry that was called the sharing economy, that I can promise you at the time, that phrase wasn't a household phrase. So you're meeting companies like your Airbnbs, your Lyfts, your DoorDashes of the world in a completely new risk, right? And from an insurance perspective, why it was really interesting is insurance is fascinated and obsessed with ownership. You own a house, you insure a house, you own a car, you insure a car. And these companies were completely flipping that on the head, saying, well, insurance linked to ownership is not what I'm looking for. I want an insurance model that's linked to utilization. So I want to insure a moment. I want to insure a night in someone else's house. I want to insure a trip in someone else's car. You know, I want something delivered by someone that doesn't work for me, right? Completely flipping the traditional models. And so it meant that we had to flip our traditional insurance product to make one that was fit for purpose for them. And what came out of that was just a real appreciation of what tech and big data can do for an insurance company, right? I know that we have a huge custodians of massive amounts of data, but you know, a lot of people will call insurance companies digital dinosaurs, right? We have a lot of data, we don't really use it and know what we could do. And I know there's a huge amount of investment going into be better with our own data. But in this scenario, we had a huge amount of client data that we thought would give us real, you know, granular insights into new areas of risk, that we could actually use that to not just price a better insurance product for them, but actually help them manage their risk better, optimize their risk better, so that ultimately you build a safer operation. So I suppose the innovation hasn't necessarily come from us at Apollo. It's just been a culture of client-first mentality. The door is open, and if someone's got something that they need a solution for, I'm not saying that we'll have the answer, but we're willing to investigate, explore, collaborate, and create an answer. So, you know, Scott, when we met and you brought the challenge to us, that's exactly what we like. Is this is super interesting, super innovative. Let's get involved.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, think about this. You think about innovation, right, and doing things that people kind of never thought of before. You know, when I was growing up, my mom always told me, never get in a stranger's car, right? We're never going to a stranger's home. And look where we are. we pay strangers to pick us up now.
Some of the biggest companies in the world.
It's awesome. And so you know, I try and pick a theme for every one of these. And I think I told you this before. Disney is my theme today, right? Walt Disney. There you go. I got his mug. He's with me. Mickey Mouse. Well, you know what's funny? When I started thinking about this, the podcast stuff, I was at Disney, and it got me thinking a lot about, you know, just exactly what you said, right? Which is, you've got something that's been done the same way over and over and over again. And insurance is very much that way, right? And, you know, I mean, you know, with the stuff we're doing with the trucking industry and commercial insurance for wheels. You know, it's the theory of insanity, right? Doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different results. And when I was walking around Disney World, I'm like, you know, he was just surrounded by innovation, you know, like things like animatronics, right? And audio animatronics. Did you ever go and see the Hall of Presidents at Disney World?
I haven't.
You haven't? Really? They've got these presidents that they just, I swear to God, you would think they're real. But they move around, and he was one of the innovators of that. But anyways, yeah, that's cool. You know what? Listen, I think thinking outside the box and looking at new ideas and figuring out how to make those ideas work is just huge. It's a big part of...
And sticking on the Disney theme, Scott, you know, you'd look at the culture within the organization of innovation. You look at how that's been taken on in the sort of future leadership. And I don't know if you've read the book, Bob Iger's book, right? Ride of a Lifetime, I think it's called. And what I found fascinating in that, and there's loads of snippets you can take out in from a business perspective. But you think about, you know, what they were facing in that challenge is where Disney was struggling somewhat as a company, looking for a new identity. And you look at them today with Disney Plus, the acquisition of Lucasfilm, the acquisition of Pixar, the acquisition of Marvel, which is, you know, huge, right? What I think I take my hat off to them is pivoting and being flexible. And being willing to change the way that they do things. I think that for me in auto risks in America, and trucking a classic example, that's kind of the challenge that we have in front of us, is to say there is absolutely a huge market need there. To your point of doing the same thing over and over again and trying to expect a result that's not going to be, you know, a tough loss ratio, it is really difficult. And riding a market cycle isn't enough for me. You have to be willing to do things differently. And I think there are now enough tools in the toolbox to put in place that you can do something. You can look at new data sources. You can look at telematics. You can look at, you know, creating behavioral dynamics and incentives for drivers that are slightly different. You can look at risk-based and routing. You know, can we look at specifically where the accidents are happening and avoid those difficult parts? So, a lot of this has been talked about. I think a lot of it is looked at in silos, but I still think it's a mass opportunity for someone to pull that all together and create a really digital insurance offering that is based off of risk, and the decisions are driven off that data that's coming through. And that's why, you know, I think what you're building is super interesting and super relevant, because I think it's the sort of thing that will make real change and help people be successful. So I love the Disney theme. I think it's something that can absolutely be working.
I love it too. You know what? I started going at a very, very early age. And, you know, I'm going to tip my hat to my mom on this one. She always taught us to think differently. Don't think like everybody else. You know, don't just be another one of the kids riding around the block on your bike. Do something bigger, you know? And you know, the funny thing is, it's kind of like you said earlier. You know, I said, okay, I when I think of innovation, I think you, right? And you said, well, people are bringing the ideas to me. You know, it's the same thing with what we're building. I mean, the data's there. It's just nobody has thought, how do you connect the dots? How do you pull them together? And how do you do it in a meaningful way so that it all makes sense? And you can start to look at what truly is causing risk. It's all there, you know? It's all there. The data drives it all.
Yeah. I agree, but I think we've got to be careful when we talk about data. And the reason why I think we've got to be careful is, you know, a lot of people will call insurers data vampires. I think they're absolutely right in many scenarios. We are willing and ingesting all of this data. We have no idea what to do with it in many cases. So I think when you even saw some of the early big, you know, the big US auto carriers start looking at telematics, if you ask them really honestly, how much were you using of the telematics data? You know, probably not a lot. And, you know, your pricing was probably the same regardless of the telematics. Now, some people would say when you put telematics in a vehicle, you create that big brother effect, which has like a 20% reduction in loss cost just because you drive differently because someone is monitoring you, right? And there's a perceived financial hit if you drive in a certain manner. Well, That's great, but in order for someone to implement a telematics product, you probably got to charge them less than a non-telematics product, because nobody wants a big brother type watching you, right? So you kind of counterbalance the reduction in loss cost with the price reduction. So all of a sudden, you're in the same net position as an insurer, but now you've spent all this money on this telematics capability and this ability to ingest big data that you're not using. So for me, it's about having a really clear data strategy. What is the data that's truly impactful for the risk that I'm writing? And how can I use that in the most efficient manner that I can, you know, drive real benefit from it, real margin from it? And I think that has to come from a partnership with the actual insureds themselves, right? So if you can start using data, not just to understand the risk and price the risk better, but you can feed that data back in a really clear and transparent manner to your insured to say, right, this is where the loss is coming from in this particular area, at this particular time of the day, with this particular cohort of drivers, with this particular type of maneuver, etc. And then you can say to them, if we can start working together on how we can avoid or how we can limit or how we can reduce and optimize the areas that are performing really well and de-risk the areas that are performing very well, that's when you can obviously all win, right? They have a lower insurance cost, you should have a lower loss ratio, the world is a safer place. That's the secret sauce. It's not just about send me loads of data and we'll give you a better price. It has to be that data partnership. And I think that is where it actually takes someone that really understands the whole ecosystem and has that partnership mentality to really unlock it. I think just because you've got a lot of data and just because you can use that data, you alone operating with it, I don't think it's going to enact a huge amount of change.
Yeah, I totally agree. You know what? I mean, I equate it, especially in our world and what we're doing, right? I equate it back to, you think about Credit Karma. You know, back in the day, people had no idea what their credit was. They had no idea if a hit came on their credit. They didn't know, you know, what was going on other than if they went to apply for a mortgage or go buy a car or whatever, and somebody pulled their credit, they'll be like, oh, hey, listen, you got something on your background here that, you know, they may or may not know about. Nowadays, people can open up their phone. I can open up Credit Karma right now and I can see what's my credit score today. What is it on all three credit bureaus? I mean, that's what we're talking about here is these truck drivers have got to understand what's going on. And the fleets, nobody even teaches them what's going to be looked at when it comes time for their insurance. They just go into it and say, all right, give me a price. And then, like you said, somebody says, well, we put these cameras in, we'll reduce your price by $2,000 a unit or whatever, right? But nobody wins. So I totally agree with you.
But Scott, there's another great example. When you talk then, you just said price per unit, right? We've always adopted price per unit in a motor setting, in an auto setting. The reason we've done that is because we didn't have digital capabilities to understand how many miles a unit would do. And it was really difficult from an accounting perspective to just take a photo of the odometer or do the odometer readings at the end of the policy, because no one really going to say, oh, wait a minute, I don't know how much my insurance cost until the end of the policy. Right? I can understand when that will be a challenge from an accounting and a business planning perspective. So that's where we embraced that the unit price per vehicle year price. I'm a big advocate that in the current climate, you know exactly from a digital perspective how many miles your vehicles are doing. I think the better business model is a per mile rating, surely. And then you start saying, okay, then it's purely about the optimization on a per mile basis. And then you start driving much more change. So there's fundamental things that, because of an advancement in technology, we can make the product much better. And we still haven't, you know, done those fundamental things. I think sometimes, you know, what you're talking about and building is three phases, is three steps beyond where a lot of people are today. And so there's a huge amount of innovation and modernization, I would say, that's required in the industry. I'd say you're absolutely leading the way on that space, but there's a lot of people have a long way to go.
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, it's funny. We just did a meeting with the dev team to kind of talk about what we're going to do next year. We got next year all planned out already. Like, I know every step we're taking, every place we're going. And I put up a picture for them, and one. And the picture was, you know, those little round animated kind of figures that you put in PowerPoints? Well, that was in my PowerPoint. And it had a red guy being followed by like seven different white, one of these round guys, and there were red footsteps. And I said, that's what I think about every single night when I go to bed. I'm like, we got to stay ahead. We got to, you know, people are going to try knocking on the door, but when you see what we've got planned for next year, oh my God, it's off the charts. It's off the charts. It's crazy. It's crazy. It's fun. It's fun stuff. Now, I had a conversation with Joe and Matt when I was out there about autonomous vehicles. Now, what do you think autonomous vehicles are going to do to the wheels industry? How far away do you think it is? Is it something that is legit? I see the Waymo cars all the time around the Phoenix Valley. It's kind of creepy when you see them with nobody in them.
Yeah. I think the whole world of autonomy is going to be one of the biggest changes we'll see in our lifetime, and one of the biggest changes as a society as a whole, right? So it's a lot of people focus on robo-taxis, and I think sometimes that can be a bit misleading, right? I think robo-taxis will probably be one of the last areas of autonomy that we will see. You're going to see, you already have a huge amount of autonomy in aviation and marine and manufacturing, right? You're starting to see a lot more in the heavy sort of industrial work. So mining is a classic candidate for a lot of autonomous vehicles, right? You know, all of that sort of stuff. I think you'll see that happen really quickly. A lot of it is already happening. What you're then looking at, if you talk about the wheel space, I think the early adopters trucking is going to be a big early adopter, in my opinion. And when you have that early adoption, I think it will have a mass effect. It may not impact the sort of last mile type operations, but the middle mile and long haul trucking, yeah, I can see that absolutely being, you know, a solution for autonomous vehicles. And I think a lot of people worry about the interaction between human drivers and autonomous vehicles. Well, if we go for it on a regulatory basis and we really get behind this, I could see a world where you have dedicated autonomous lanes, right? Or a dedicated autonomous highway. A bit like you have on, if you've got three passengers in the vehicle, you're in the pooling lane, right?
Right.
So I can see that sort of future being adopted really quickly. I think one of the areas actually that hasn't caught up with the innovation in technology is probably the insurance of autonomous vehicles, right? You know, if we get into real insurance geek territory here, you know, the argument is always, is it an auto risk? I would argue it's not, because most auto insurance policies will say triggered by an accident. An autonomous vehicle doesn't really have an accident because it makes a cognitive decision, right? It decides to do what it does. It doesn't, it's not, you know, tired. It's not texting. It's not distracted, right? So I don't see how it can cause an accident to trigger the policy in the first place. Then if you think, are we in the general liability space or the product liability space, potentially that you could say an autonomous vehicle is a product, but then products liability and general liability have a very different insurance structure and limit structure and how they work to auto, right? So how would a regulator deal with that? Then you get the big one is it cyber, right? Everything's tech related, you know, for it to causing and have an incident and occurrence, is it caused by cyber, and how does cyber work with the policies? And when we start going down this road, you realize the insurance industry is doing it again. We're making the biggest mistake again. We're forcing, you know, a square peg into a round hole. It doesn't need to be any of those things. But the problem with innovation in insurance setting is, you know, we don't like doing it. We don't like changing the way that we've been. So rather than stick within our silos, we have to create a new class, a new product, and it needs to be autonomous vehicle liability insurance, right? And then you create probably an all-risk policy, exclude the bits you don't want, but you affirmatively say, it doesn't matter what one of these buckets is, we've created a new bucket, it is covered. And then you start thinking about, okay, well, what does the insurance look like then for one of these autonomous vehicles? Is it going to be a lower risk? Is it going to be a higher risk? Or is insurance going to be so much cheaper? Is it going to be so much more expensive? Now, I think you are going to have a huge reduction in frequency because of all those things that I just talked about, right? Distracted driving, tiredness, all this sort of thing, right? The autonomous vehicle will drive better than a human. I have no doubt about that. I've seen myself drive. The problem you've got, especially in the United States, is the severity issue. Now, because of the legal system in the United States, you're going to be in front of juries. And we've seen in the trucking, you know, reptilian theory in courtrooms, we've seen social inflation, nuclear verdicts. If the trucking industry is the one that's massively disrupted by autonomous vehicles, I suspect that the lawyers, the plaintiff's lawyers that have been incredibly successful in nuclear verdicts, are not just going to decide, hey, the game is up, we're done, trucking is you know, no longer driven by humans, it's autonomous vehicles, let's find a different one, let's sail off into the sunset. Absolutely not. Their target will become the autonomous vehicle companies, and there will be accidents. I'm in doubt about that. No system is perfect. Nothing. That's a mathematically sound theory. Nothing is perfect. So when there is an accident, that's the point when it's going to be a really, really tough defense of that type of incident. And that's where I think you'll have a massive increase in severity. Not necessarily severity of injury, because if you believe in autonomous vehicles, it should brake quicker, it should go at a better speed. But you think about how that plays out in a courtroom. And maybe I've watched, you know, too many Tom Cruise movies, but let me paint these two scenarios for you, Scott. Right. I've got a human driver that's got in an accident, and I'm the defense lawyer, and I would say something of the nature of, look, John was in an accident. He'd been working all day providing to put food on the table for his children, his family. He's tired. He's got into an accident. He hasn't done this on purpose. Let's not throw the book at John. As a jury, I can sit there and I can relate to that story, right? If then I'm in a mobile courtroom and now it's an autonomous vehicle owned by a humongous car company or tech company or whoever owns it, if that, I'm going to flip onto the plaintiff's side. I'll be like, for $10,000, they could have done another test. They didn't do that test. There's now been an incident, and these vehicles are on our roads, endangering our children, endangering our family and loved ones. We can't just give them a small fine, a small slap on the wrist here. There's such a big balance sheet on their revenue. We need to fine them $1 billion to teach them a lesson to appreciate safety of our community. Scary stuff if you're an insurance company.
It is.
And that's the sort of thing that I think autonomous vehicle brings a huge challenge for insurance. And I don't know if there's enough eyes on that. It's certainly something we spend a lot of time thinking about and creating products for, but there's a huge way to go in that. So I think, yes, it's coming. I don't think the insurance world is ready.
Yeah, you know what? I agree with you on every one of those points. That's the same stuff that I said to Joe and Mal when we were talking about it. And I'm like, you know what? It's up in my mind, and I've been thinking a lot about this, right? Because we're building something for what it is today and what we're going to make it tomorrow. But then the next day is going to come right after that. As sure as the sun goes down, it's going to come back up, right? And so I look at autonomous vehicles and I say, you know what? All it is just different data points. You know, you got to think about, and I think it crosses so many different lines, right? You're going to have a position where, I don't know about you, but when my computer needs an update and I get started in the morning and I sit down, I'm like, oh, Jesus, I got all these emails to get through. I got to get caught up. I'll take care of the update later, right? And then I get to the next morning and the same thing happens again. Or I sit on a plane and I start working and I get an update. I'm like, no, I'll take care of it later. Before you know it, I've kicked that update down the road about 6 weeks and my computer's been operating at whatever speed it's operating at because I haven't done my update. Well, what if that happens with a truck? What if they don't click the button to update it? Or what if it goes into the shop and the mechanic screws things up, right? I mean, I think we're just going to see, you know, data points like when was it serviced? What kind of service did it have? What kind of brakes were put? I mean, the computer can tell the truck to hit the brakes at any point in time, but if the brakes aren't good, the truck's going to crash, right? So I'm absolutely fascinated by autonomous vehicles because I think there's going to be a gigantic opportunity to do just what you said. Is everything's got to change. You got to look at it differently. And then, like, we had, three or four years. What's that?
I mean, with the looking at things differently, you know, the easiest one, the example I give is even still with the underwriting lens on, it's easy to sometimes get caught up into what we know and history know about cars. So, for instance, you might say some of the early questions we'd ask autonomous vehicle companies was, how much testing do you do night versus daytime? Is that a data point that I can charge more for nighttime miles than daytime miles? And that is a data point we use in other lines of auto. And, you know, the autonomous vehicle companies would say to us, well, our vehicle performs better at night because there's no glare on the sensors. And so, but in your head, you're inherently ingrained and you'd say, wait a minute, nighttime driving is riskier though. So, but it's not for autonomous vehicle. You've got to reset everything you know about the risk of a car because it is different in an autonomous vehicle world.
Yeah. Well, if you sit in a Tesla and you watch the data that those things are tracking, it is It's crazy. It's crazy. I was in Nashville a couple days ago visiting an insurance agency, and I was in a Tesla on the way to the airport. And the Tesla, you know, it's got the little cars driving by you, right? It knew whether it was a pickup truck or a minivan or an SUV or a motorcycle, like the little black figures that are driving by. It knows. It's insane. Somebody walking on the side of the street picks it up. Little bag on the side of the street picks it up. It's crazy. It is crazy how sophisticated those cars are. So yeah, to hear that, you know, it's better at night, I could believe it. I could believe it totally.
Tesla is the one that I've got. It's the one that I keep in my mind when I think about, you know, when you're trying to innovate, you're trying to build stuff and do stuff that's new. It could be a bit of a topsy-turvy type life, right? One minute it's amazing, the next minute it's the worst day ever, because nothing goes smoothly, right, when you're trying to...
I feel that, trust me, I feel
Tesla's
that.
The one that... Yeah, but I bet you do. Tesla's the one that keeps me on the straight and narrow, though, because they're the one that have fired a warning shot across the bow for an insurance, right? Elon has very openly said, if the insurance world continues to ignore the safety improvements and the tech and the data that I have within this Tesla world, I will insource insurance. And I don't think you should take that lightly, right? I'm pretty sure Elon Musk can raise some capital. You know, he can get together with some, build an insurance company, and all of a sudden, Tesla insurance is a major competitor that we need to take stock of. So the way I look at that is there are some big companies with some huge aspirations that want to innovate and create new product. And we have to partner with them and create insurance solutions that are fit for purpose for them. Otherwise, just like Elon said, they'll find their own solution. And you know, that's not what we want as an industry.
Yeah, totally agree. It's incredible. The autonomous stuff, I think about it all the time. I really do. I think about it all the time. It's just data. You know, everybody I talk to now, and I talk to them about what we're doing, and I talk about all these different programs we're going to introduce down at the level with the trucking company and the trucks, you know, like fitness, right? Where we just launched a new fitness program. Well, the guy that we're working with, he gets the data from Apple Watches and Fitbits. So imagine now if you have pulse, sleeping habits, walking habits, all those different data points fed into your risk machine. And you butt that up against everything else and compare it with losses and crashes. It's crazy. Or maintenance, you know, a maintenance program. And you know how many times they take their trucks in to get tires put on. Do they have four different types of tires on the truck? Two? Three? What kind of tires do they have on their truck? Never know. And then even stuff like fuel. You know, you were talking about mileage. So we got a fuel card program coming out. Well, we know when did they pump their fuel? How much? What mileage were they at? How many gallons did they put in? How much did they pay? And you start wrapping all that stuff together, it's crazy. The data's there. It's crazy.
That's the data piece, I think, is definitely key. I mean, with autonomous vehicles, you are going to get this phenomenon of the perceived risk is so much higher than the actual risk. The data that we have for autonomous vehicles shows, you know, compared to other forms of transportation, and I'll admit, right, some of the testing is done in very controlled environments. Increasingly so, you're going to see companies testing on the streets in San Francisco. Undoubtedly, autonomous vehicles are lower cost per mile. That's undoubtable from the data that we've seen. But here's something to throw you as well. A similar example where people are scared of the unknown or things they don't know about, but if they see the data and they learn the data, you can make it educate decisions, right? E-scooters is a great example of that. Now, I'm sure everyone will have their own opinions on e-scooters, right? I've seen it a lot. People calling them death traps, you know, these dangerous vehicles. How can these cities do that? We insure a lot of them. And I can tell you now, the data is very clear. On a per mile basis, it is a much safer form of transportation than driving or taking a ride share, right? Much safer. And so it's having that data to be able to make informed decisions, to make risk-based decisions. And maybe we as an industry need to share that data a bit wider, right, with policymakers, with state officials, because the success of our future of transportation will be a number of different things. You're going to have big trucks for middle mile and long haul. You're going to have last mile solutions that are smaller trucks, box trucks, you know, and you know, private passenger vehicles. And then you've got that micromobility piece that you can't ignore, right? When you're getting around in a city areas, it doesn't need to be a car, a greener form of energy. And as long as we can keep feeding that data in, making those operations safer, then the whole ecosystem works. And then I think you've got the autonomous vehicle that just disrupts everything. But it's all underpinned by data. And it does frustrate me sometimes. I see a lot of people saying, oh, isn't that really, really dangerous? And I go, well, have you seen the data? And they obviously have not, right? And if you're going to read, if you're going to believe everything you read in the press, you're probably not going to have the right opinion.
Well, if it's on the internet, it's true, right?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, you know what? Actually, I think that is a very good point because I myself have thought, okay, those things are, they're death traps, right? But I don't know. I don't have the data. I don't have the data. And I've seen cities shut it down because they claim that that's the case. And I guarantee you, they don't have the data either. Yeah, that's interesting.
No, and you're quite right. They look at things like hospital admissions, et cetera, et cetera. Never will they overlay them or compare them with the amount of hospital admissions for motor vehicles, right? And a lot of the times when you look at the actual incidents or what's caused the losses in that sector, it's people not abiding by the rules of the road. It's very rarely an issue with the product itself. And so then I'd flip it back on the city to say, well, what are you doing about policing this? You wouldn't let someone drive through a red light in a car, but you're allowing them to drive through a red light with on a scooter, and you're not, you know, punishing them, right? If you punish it really, really quickly and say, right, you get points on your license, or you get a fine, or you get, you know, a driving violation, even though it's an e-scooter, there's a real, you know, deterrent. There's a real penalty for doing that. You change the culture and you eliminate a huge amount of the risk. So I think the city officials, whilst they might have the right data, they also have to take a responsibility that you have to police it. You have to manage the operation. There's limitations to what the actual e-scooter operator themselves can do, because they can't penalize their riders for going through a red light. They're not empowered to do that. So,
right.
Again, if you look at the data and those city officials, and we could partner with them, we can absolutely show the data, show where those losses come from, and they can enact policy changes that will make it a safer operation. So I'm a big believer in all those buckets in mobility, and micro included, but I'm only a believer in that because I've seen the data. I see what we can eliminate if we do it.
Right. That makes total sense. It's just, again, it's just opening everybody's eyes to what's going on, you know, and the idea and the concept behind, you know, just kind of thinking, you know, what you know, versus actually getting the physical data and understanding it. It's huge. It's huge. I never knew they were actually safer.
Yeah. Imagine why actuaries will absolutely frustrate me, because they do this annoying exercise where we'll have a topic of conversation. Maybe it's on autonomous vehicles, maybe it's on last mile delivery or rideshare or something of that nature, and more on the innovation for mobility, because it's got to be so uncertain. And they'll load you with a question. They'll say, what do you think is safe? What do you think is risky? What do you think is a higher loss cost? This scenario or this scenario? They know because they've already seen the data. And then you're squirming going, well, it's probably that, but it could be the other one. And then they just sit there laughing because, again, you have no idea in many cases, and you're often really surprised because the data doesn't necessarily follow what you would think it would. You know, we tried in early rideshare days, we tried to look into studies where we could get an early indicator of when a driver was going to have a loss. We looked at all things, right? Was it, you know, the number of trips they'd done, the type of vehicle they drove, was the owner of a Tesla more likely to get into a crash than an owner of a Toyota Prius? We looked at all sorts of things. And one of the leading indicators none of us would have expected was whether they had had a comment on the cleanliness of the vehicle. So those drivers had comments saying the vehicle was dirty, were statistically the most likely to get in an accident. Didn't matter. It was a bigger indicator than all the other characteristics. So I'm guessing somebody who doesn't take their time to clean your vehicle is a sloppy driver. Maybe that's it. But that would never be the data point you'd have guessed. Right. But that's all the data, you know, for about, so the next time you're in a vehicle, make sure that it's a really clean one.
Well, my dad was in the Air Force. I was taught to always iron my clothes, always clean up after myself, always make my bed in the morning. When he'd come home from work, he literally said this to me one time. He's like, listen, you are my oldest son. I don't care who made the mess. When I come home from work, I want it clean. So yeah, that's how I grew up.
Like that, I love that.
Well, awesome. I think I could go on forever with all this stuff. I love it. I absolutely.
Yeah, likewise.
I'm intrigued by anything that's new. I say to people all the time, I think I'm addicted to disruption. As soon as you see something that is working well, I always think to myself, well, there's got to be a better way. I mean, this can't be the best that there is.
We have a lot of conversations internally at the moment about what are the attributes that make an elite underwriter.
Uh-huh.
And we're always looking at, you know, casting the net wider to attract the best talent into our organization. And quite often you get the classics, right? Some degree of mathematically minded, right? Because a lot of this is numbers, right? You get people that are good work ethic, right? Someone that's agile, someone that's innovative. Yeah, someone that's a good at making relationships, a good communicator, right? Because we are definitely in a people business. And the one attribute that I think increasingly so, and I'd say, you know, the people in my team definitely always got you, I'm in spades clearly, is curiosity. I want someone that's curious. I want someone that's willing to always probe and investigate something and really look into something, because it's those sort of people that find solutions in the best places and places you wouldn't normally look. And quite often that's what separates you from others. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm always trying to look at something I don't know about, or I've always got FOMO, fear of missing out. I want to know what everyone's shiny toys are and what they're working on.
I totally agree. You know, I think to some extent, I disappointed my dad when I was 18. I was the first oldest son in 5 generations that did not go into the military. And as I was approaching that age, my dad said, okay, you're gonna try the military, because he's very proud of his service. I'm very proud of him for his service. And I'm like, Dad, I can't do it. I can't do it. And he's like, why not? I go, I won't make it through basic training. And he goes, but you played sports your whole life. You'll be fine. And I go, no, it's not that. I said, if they tell me in basic training, I have got to go left, and I see that right is a better way, there's no way I'm going to go left. I'm going to get kicked out. So I never went. Yeah. It's just a different way of thinking. You know, a lot of people
have been before it's gone.
I know, right? But now, you know, back in the day, I'm like, oh, he goes, you know, if you would have gotten through that, you know what you could have done for the government? I'm like, I don't think the government would have listened. good stuff. Well, all right. Well, listen, thanks so much for your time today. I always love talking to you. I love talking to your team. By the way, your team is awesome. Joe and Matt are, they're some of my favorites. Yeah,
they're big fans. I'm looking forward to having you in London.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'll be out there in a few days. We'll spend some time together, talk more about this stuff, because I love it. I love it. And I can't wait to tell you about where we're at. It's exciting.
Yeah.
I'm super excited about this. Cool. Well, listen, have a great rest of the day. I know it's later there. Early here. Sun's about to come up.
Yeah, cheers.
All right. See ya. Thanks a lot. Peace.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed our show today. Remember, when it comes to creativity and innovation, I always like to quote one of my favorite lines out of the movie Tommy Boy. If you ain't growing, you're dying. There ain't no third direction. My name's Scott Grandis. I'll see you on the next show. Peace.